Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now covering Deuteronomy 5, verses 1 through 33, the Ten Commandments. Our context is this. Moses is giving his speeches to the sons of Israel on the plains of Moab. In chapter 4, our previous chapter, he's already given them his first discourse, which mainly could be summarized by the concept, idolatry is a no-no. And so now he proceeds to give a rehash of what happened at Mount Sinai at the giving of the Ten Commandments. So we start now in Deuteronomy 5, verses 1 through 3. Then Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I am speaking today in your hearing, that you may learn them and observe them carefully. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, with all those of us alive here today." Now Moses summoned all Israel. What does that mean? Here's some options given to us by John Gill. First, it could have meant a general assembly of every last one of the Israelites. All 2 million of them, if you just take the men, 600,000. Leave out the women and children, that's still too many. But Jameson Fawcett Brown suggests even that is possible. I find that unlikely. Another option is that Moses repeated the law to separate parties and bodies of them until all heard. So Moses is going around to a bunch of groups and repeating himself? I don't think so. I think that John Gill and Jameson Fawcett and Brown, when they suggest that Moses was speaking to the heads of tribes and other elders of the people, in other words, the leaders of the people, and then the leaders took it and carried the news back to the people, I think that is what is correct, is what happened. Now, Moses says to the people that our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. Horeb, of course, is another name for Mount Sinai. Horeb is the normal name that's used in the book of Deuteronomy. And Moses says in verse 3, the Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us. Now, the most common and easiest way to understand who those fathers were the fathers of the Israelites then living there at the plains of Moab. The fathers had all died out, those who were under 20 at the taking of the first census. They had all died out and died in the wilderness before they crossed the brook Zered into Moab. They had died because the fathers had not listened to the report of the two favorable, the good spies, Joshua and Caleb, but they listened to the report of the 10 unfaithful spies who said, no, the villages are fortified to heaven and we look like grasshoppers in their sight because they're giants and we can't take this place. Well, God said, okay, boom, you're all going to die. So what Moses is saying, what he's saying is the Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, although actually he did. But what he's saying is he did not make this covenant merely with our fathers, but with us also. You know, the word mere and also solves a lot of problems in interpreting the Bible, I've discovered, and this is another example. And the reason that God made the covenant with the children as well as with the fathers is because the fathers were representative of the children. To put it in fancy theological words, I guess you could say they're the federal head of the children. Now, there's another way you can interpret that word fathers. You could say the Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but he made it with us. Well, if you'd say that, then you will say that the Mosaic covenant is different than the Abrahamic covenant. I don't know why Moses would pick this time to say that. So I don't think that's the right answer. It's suggested by Gill. But if it is the right answer, then that would mean that the Mosaic covenant is not a continuance of the patriarchal covenant because the Lord did not make this covenant with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the fathers, but he made it with us. There's a contrast there. And that, of course, would have implications for Reformed theology, which says that there's one covenant of grace between the son of Adam all the way through Abraham and Moses, Noah, and then Abraham and Moses, and then Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and then through Moses. And so there wouldn't be a disjunction there between the Abrahamic covenant and the Mosaic covenant. But verse 3, if you read it this way, the Lord did not make this covenant, this Mosaic covenant with our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That puts a disjunction between the two covenants. And although I don't believe in the covenant of grace, I don't think this is a good verse to argue against it. I think he's just talking about his fathers, the fathers who died in the wilderness. And what Moses is trying to say, you know, this famous covenant of Mount Horeb, which I'm getting ready to recount with you, remember now, it wasn't just with those guys back then, your fathers, it's with us too, and so we need to obey it also. I think that makes a lot more sense in the context. So we go down to Deuteronomy 5, verses 4 through 5. The Lord spoke to you face to face, and again, the you is Israel, but not the exact same individual members of Israel because these kids were not present at the speaking. Probably not. They might have been little kids, maybe. But no, the you there is referring to Israel, not individuals in Israel. The individuals who were spoken to were the fathers who had not died yet by falling in the wilderness because of their sin. So verse 4, the Lord spoke to you face to face at the mountain from the midst of the fire, while I was standing between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire and did not go up the mountain. All right, so Moses is speaking face to face. Now that phrase is used to describe, is often used to describe Moses' communication with God. It's meant to mean free and friendly and familiar intercourse. We read in Exodus 33, verse 11, first part of the verse, thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. But now John Gill says here the speaking face to face means something different than intimate discourse. It means that God spoke publicly, audibly, and distinctly. And I think that's probably true because that's exactly what God did here. He didn't, but it was not a form that the people saw. They didn't see God's form face to face. We don't take the phrase literally, because we'll see in just a minute. They only heard the voice. They didn't see a form. So face to face here does not mean literally face to face. And it probably means more than just intimate discourse. It was public and audible discourse, distinct discourse. Now, I said that the face-to-face does not mean visibly or corporeally that the people saw God. Jameson Foster Brown agrees with that and quotes Deuteronomy 4:12, last chapter. Then the Lord spoke to you, spoke to Israel, from the midst of the fire. You heard the sound of words, but you saw no form, only a voice. Deuteronomy 4:15, so watch yourselves carefully, since you did not see any form on the day the Lord spoke to you at Horeb from the midst of the fire. So the people are standing below the mountain, smoke and fire coming out of the mountain, and God is speaking to them audible words that they could hear, but they could not see his form. Now, what's the fire that God is speaking from? This is probably the fire coming from the top of Mount Sinai, assuming Mount Sinai was volcanic. I assume that's what it is. I mean, fire can mean lightning, too. Could have been lightning storm, but whatever. It was awesome. John Gill says that fire is a fitting symbol of the old legal dispensation of Moses, because the idea is you disobey, you are destroyed. Deuteronomy 28, the curses, you recall. Moses says that he was standing between the Lord and you, Israel, because Moses was a mediator, like Christ was a mediator. He got the words that the people heard, the Ten Commandments, orally, but the rest of it, they were so scared. Moses went up, talked to God face to face, intimately, wrote down the words and brought them back to the people. So he was a mediator. And we know later on when the people sinned, he was also going, God, the people have sinned, please strike me dead, but don't kill them. Sounds a lot like Jesus, does it not? So Moses is a type of Jesus. He's a mediator, just like Christ is. The Chinese word for mediator is Mei Ren, which Mei means in between, and Ren means person. He's an in-between person. Moses refers to the fact that he was a mediator at that time. Well, that's going back at Mount Sinai, which is about 38 years earlier or so, 38 plus years. And let me read you what happened then. Exodus 20, verses 18 through 21. All the people perceived the thunder and the lightning flashes and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. Then they said to Moses, speak to us yourself, and we will listen. But let not God speak to us, or we will die. Moses said to the people, do not be afraid, for God has come in order to test you. For God has come in order to test you, and in order that the fear of him may remain with you, so that you may not sin. So the people stood at a distance while Moses approached the thick cloud where God was. Very dramatic situation there. Moses, by the way, went up and down that mountain. I think people count it differently 7 or 8 times. And I always get confused as exactly when he was up and when he was down. But here he was down and Moses says, okay, you guys need to stay back. I'm going up. And then Moses went up and talked to God directly. I'd be scared to go talk to God directly, quite frankly. I think that took a lot of guts on Moses' part. Moses in the Old Testament, there was no figure in the Old Testament that's closer to God than Moses. I mean, he even argued with God. God, you know, I really would like to go see the promised land. Please let me go in. I mean, you know, maybe that's his personality. I would tend to say, whatever you say, God, you want me to jump high, I'll jump that high, but I'm not going to argue with you. But Moses did. Moses says in verse 5 that at that time back at Mount Sinai, 38 plus years earlier, that he stood between God and the people to declare to the people the word of the Lord. Now, what Moses declared, the word of the Lord that Moses declared, was not the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments were spoken directly by God himself, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out. The rest of the law Moses relayed to the people. Moses gave them the details. But the Ten Commandments, the summary of the law, was given orally to the people. I think we're going to see that in a few verses here. Now we go to verses 6 through 21. Now this is a rehash of the Ten Commandments. It's almost word for word what we saw in Exodus 20, verses 3 through 17. So I'm not going to read them all to you again. I know you know what the Ten Commandments are. But I will make a few comments on some of the verses here. First of all, there are some minor differences between Exodus, the Exodus version of the Ten Commandments, and the Deuteronomy 5 version. Here's what John Gill says, quote, those commands are here delivered in the same order and pretty near in the same words, with a little variation and a few additions. In other words, the differences are minor. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, quote, the commandments which follow are, with a few slight verbal alterations, the same as formerly recorded in Exodus 20, verses 1 through 17. And in some of them, there is a distinct reference to that promulgation. In other words, going through here, there's a reference back to Exodus 20, which I will not take note of because I don't know where they are. So that's the first comment I want to make, and I want to make a comment about two of the commandments. The first is the Sabbath day commandment, verse 15. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out of there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. Now here we have a reason for the Sabbath day, because you were a slave and then you got out by God. Therefore, you observe the Sabbath day. Well now, what's the therefore? Well, it's because now God is saying you are going to take a rest from the slavery of Egypt. You were a slave, you got out, therefore you can rest. And that's what the Sabbath day stands for, is a rest. So there's one of the purposes of the Sabbath day, to commemorate the deliverance from slavery of the Israelites to the Egyptians. Now, another comment on purposes of the Sabbath comes from Adam Clark. He says, quote, we see, therefore, that God has three grand ends in view by appointing a Sabbath. Number one, to commemorate the creation. All right, there's another reason. God worked 6 days. On the seventh day, he rested. Well, God, we create, and we're in the image of God. Like Paul says, imitate me as I imitate Christ. There's another verse which I can't pull up right now about imitating God. So we're supposed to imitate God, and God rested on his seventh day. Maybe we ought to rest on our seventh day too. So that's the second purpose of the Sabbath, is rest on to honor God's creation of the world, to reflect it. And then there's a practical reason too. This is Clark's second reason, to give a due proportion of rest to man and beast. This is the reason I just gave. They were slaves, and now they are free, and so we're going to commemorate that. When in Egypt they had no rest, their cruel taskmasters caused them to labor without intermission. Now God had given rest, and as he had showed them mercy, he teaches them to show mercy to their servants. Remember that thou wast a servant. Okay, so let's put all that together. Reasons for the Sabbath. One, to reflect creation week. God rested, we rest. Number two, to reflect the idea that Israel is no longer slaves. They are resting from slavery. And I would add a third reason, practical reason. People work better when they take one day off and seven resting. I mean, that's even true today. That was true back then, too. You get more work done, less accidents, more productivity during the first 6 days if you rest 1 and 7 days, because you're imitating what God did. So that's the third reason, practical reason. You're more productive when you rest. You're more healthy. So three good reasons for the Sabbath. Now, I will say this. I do not believe that we're under that fourth commandment, the Sabbath commandment, because that's the Old Testament. We're in the New Testament. We enter into the rest, which, of course, and I guess another reason for the Sabbath. Let me give a fourth reason for the Sabbath. It's a type of the antitype, which is rest in Christ, resting from our works, righteousness, in order to try to get justified before God, Hebrews chapter 4. So the Sabbath has a lot of purposes. It's very important. It was a sign of the Old Testament covenant, the Mosaic covenant, the Sabbath. Very important, but we're not under it anymore. And all these people who are preaching that we are under it, these Presbyterians, well, they don't worship on Saturday. They worship on Sunday, and they've got some hot dog fancy theology to get from Saturday to Sunday. It's the most arcane and convoluted and twisted bunch of theology I've ever read. I like Occam's razor. If you've got to make something real complicated like that, it's probably not true. Maybe you better slice off all the complications and get down to the simplicity of it. In Christ, we are not under Moses anymore. We're in Christ. And in Christ, we rest from our labors. Now, I'm not saying that's not a good idea to rest from work. Fine, but it doesn't have to be on Saturday or Sunday. Pick a day and rest, or just pick a method to rest. Rest is a good principle, but the Saturday Sabbath rest in the Old Testament is not, unless you're a legalist, is not commanded to the New Testament Christian. All right, that's my comments on the fourth commandment, the Sabbath commandment. Now, how about the honor your father and mother, the next commandment, fifth commandment. Honor your father and mother, that your days may be prolonged and that it may go well with you. Paul quotes that, I'm sure you remember. He quotes it in Ephesians 6:3. Interestingly, he quotes the Deuteronomy version, not the Exodus version, because those words, that it may go well with you, that's not in Exodus, it's only in Deuteronomy. So that's an important addition. Most of the additions were minor. Here's an important addition, that it may go well with you, a promise. The only commandment with a promise, things will go well with you if you honor your father and mother. Now, this idea of things going well with you if you obey the law, that's not just in this one commandment. It's also generally true that if you obey the law, good things will happen. Let's read Joshua 1:8. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous. Then you will have success. Ooh, I hope I don't sound like Benny Hinn or Gloria Copeland or Kenneth Copeland when I say that. No, I'm quoting not them. I'm quoting Joshua, the inspired leader of Israel, inspired with a word of the Old Testament canon. You'll make your way prosperous if you keep the word in your mouth. Also, we see in just a minute, we'll get down to verse 33 of Deuteronomy 5. You shall walk in all the way which the Lord has commanded you, that you may live and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you shall possess. So it's not just the fifth commandment there. But as all the commandments, you do them, you'll do well, you'll prosper. End of story. We don't want to react against that heinous heresy, the health and wealth, blab it and grab it, scream it and redeem it, confess and profess it heresy that has afflicted the church. Yeah, I despise it too, but let's don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, please. Let's go now to Deuteronomy 5, verses 22 and 23. These words the Lord spoke to all your assembly at the mountain from the midst of the fire, of the cloud, and of the thick gloom, with a great voice, and then he added no more. He wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me. And when you heard the voice from the midst of the darkness, while the mountain was burning with fire, you came near to me, all the heads of your tribes and your elders. Now these words, the NIV translates as these commandments. Some people say, well, actually the Hebrew is the ten words, but that sounds bad in English, so we say the Ten Commandments. So it's these Ten Commandments the Lord spoke to all your assembly. There's the oral speaking of the Ten Commandments. And then Moses went up and wrote down the rest of the law, and Moses conveyed the law to the people, not in an intermediate fashion, not directly. God didn't convey the law to the people directly, the details of the law. But the Ten Commandments, the summary of the law, he did convey directly. Now this cloud and thick gloom at the top of the mountain, that cloud could have been the pillar of cloud of fire that led the people around, but I don't think so. I believe it was either rain clouds or smoke from a volcanic fire, which of course would cause the thick gloom. It says here that when God spoke the Ten Commandments to the assembly of the people at the foot of the mountain, that he, God, added no more. In other words, Ten Commandments, and that's it. Now, of course, as I said earlier, he didn't add any more because he was planning to add the rest of the law to Moses up there on the mountain as Moses went up to talk to him face to face. We go down to Deuteronomy 5, verses 24 through 27. You, this is Moses speaking to Israel, you, Israel, said, Behold, the Lord our God has shown us his glory and his greatness, and we have heard his voice from the midst of the fire. We have seen today that God speaks with man, yet he lives. Now then, why should we die? For this great fire will consume us if we hear the voice of the Lord our God any longer, then we will die. For who is there of all flesh who has heard the voice of the living God speaking from the midst of the fire as we have and lived? Go near and hear. This is the people speaking to Moses. Moses, go near, Go near to God and hear all that the Lord our God says. Then speak to us all that the Lord our God speaks to you, and we will hear and do it. In other words, we need a mediator. Moses, go up there on the mountain, listen to God, and we're not going to listen to him directly anymore. It's too awesome. Now, the people in verse 25 said directly, we're going to die if we hear anymore. That's just hearing. Now, it was commonly believed that if you saw God, you would die too. Of course, a fortiori. Let's look at some scriptures that show that common belief. Genesis 32:30. So Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. So Jacob says, well, how could I wrestle with God and then live? Because I thought that I would die when I saw God. Exodus 33:20. But he, that's God, said to Moses, you cannot see my face, for no man can see me and live. Well, see there, you can't see God and live. Exodus 33:22, and it will come about when my glory is passing by that I will put you in the cleft of the rock and cover you with my hand until I pass by. So Moses can't see God, so he won't die. All right, so how do we handle this idea that Moses saw God face to face and yet he lived to talk about it? I don't know why. I've always had a mental block about that concept. It's actually not that complicated. First of all, when Moses saw God spake face to face, like in Exodus 33:11, thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face. That is showing intimate, friendly communications. It's not meant to be taken literally so that Moses is looking directly at the face of God and God is looking directly into the face of Moses. That's not what it means. Exodus 33:11, in fact, explains that phrase face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. It's friendly communication. And so that's one way that you avoid the problem of how you can see God face to face and live, is because face to face doesn't mean literally seeing him. It just means intimately talking with him. The other way that you explain how you can see God, quote unquote, face to face and yet live, is if God's glory was shielded. For example, when Jacob was wrestling with the angel of Jehovah, probably Jesus, that was an epiphany of God in a human form. So the glory of God was shielded by his human form, and so he didn't die. I mean, think about Jesus. A lot of people saw Jesus. They didn't die. Why? They were looking at God, but they didn't die. Why? Because God's divinity was shielded by his humanity. Now, to back me up on this, I've gone to a website which has the greatest quantity of excellent theological articles and biblical articles I've ever seen, gotquestions.org. And this is what they say, quote, the Bible tells us that no man has ever seen God except the Lord Jesus Christ. That's John 1:18. In Exodus 33:20, God declares, you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. These scriptures seem to contradict other scriptures which describe various people seeing God. For example, 33:19-23 describes Moses speaking to God face to face. How could Moses speak with God face to face if no one can see God's face and live? In this instance, the phrase face to face is a figure of speech indicating they were in very close communion, which is what I just said. So gotquestions.org backs me up. God and Moses were speaking to each other as if they were two human beings having a close conversation. All right, that takes care of the face-to-face. Now let's talk about another way that you can see God's face and live. Genesis 32:30, Jacob saw God appearing as an angel. He did not truly see God. Samson's parents were terrified when they realized they had seen God in Judges 13:22, but they had only seen him appearing as an angel. Jesus was God in the flesh, so when people saw him, they were seeing God. So yes, God can be seen, and many people have seen God, and seen being in quotes. At the same time, no one has ever seen God revealed in all his glory. In our fallen human condition, if God were to fully reveal himself to us, we would be consumed and destroyed. Therefore, God veils himself and appears in forms in which we can, quote-unquote, see him. However, this is different than seeing God with all his glory and holiness displayed. People have seen visions of God, images of God, and appearances of God, but no one has ever seen God in all his fullness. Okay, that should take care of that little problem. Now in verse 27, Moses is still recounting what happened back at Sinai. The people say to Moses in verse 27, Moses, go near and hear all that the Lord our God says, then speak to us all that the Lord our God speaks to you, and we will hear and do it. Yeah, famous last words. They really were obedient right after that. Not very long after that was the horrible incident of the worship of the golden calf. And then there was Korah's rebellion. Then there was the refusal to listen to the two good spies. On and on and on they rebelled. At Taberah, remember the quail incident. On and on and on they rebelled. Famous last words. We're going to do everything you say, God. Yeah, right. We go now to Deuteronomy 5, verses 28 and 29. The Lord heard the voice of your words when you spoke to me. This is Moses speaking back to the people of Israel. And the Lord said to me, Moses, the Lord said to me, Moses, I have heard the voice of the words of this people which they have spoken to you. They have done well in all that they have spoken. Yeah, what they spoke, but what they did is a different question. Oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and keep all my commandments always, that it may be well with them and with their sons forever. There's another verse that talks about if you obey, things will go well. I left that out when I was discoursing upon that earlier. So God says, yeah, what they spoke was very good, but I'm adding this idea, what they did was horrible. We go down to Deuteronomy 5, verses 30 through 33. God continues speaking to Moses. Go, Moses, say to them, return to your tents. But as for you, stand here by me, that I may speak to you all the commandments and the statutes and the judgments which you shall teach them, that they may observe them in the land which I give them to possess. So you shall observe to do just as the Lord your God has commanded you. You shall not turn aside to the right or to the left. You shall walk in all the way which the Lord your God has commanded you, that you may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you will possess. Now, in the second discourse, as I've said earlier, Moses is talking about the law and keeping the law and how it'll be good if you keep the law. And if you keep the law, you'll prosper when you get into the land, into the promised land, when you cross the Jordan River. And this is just a summary here. Obey, obey, obey. And of course, Moses is speaking after the fact of a lot of disobedience. And so that's why he's repeating all this stuff, I'm sure, where God had told him earlier, you're going to prosper, you're going to do well, it'll be well with you, verse 33, it'll be well with you, but you've got to obey, obey. You want to prolong your days in the land of Canaan where we're going? You've got to obey the law, which of course he didn't. Verse 30, God tells Moses to say to them, return to your tents. Remember, the people are standing at the foot of Mount Sinai, waiting for Moses to come down. And so God tells Moses, come on back down, get down there and say, go back to your tents. You've heard the Ten Commandments. Now you sit there for a while. Meanwhile, I'm going to tell Moses the details of the law so he can write them down and bring them back to you. And let me repeat verse 38. If you'll do what the Lord has commanded you, why? So that you may live and it may be well with you. This is an idea that is not just here. In Joshua 1:8, I'll repeat this verse again. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success. Prosperous means to have good success. It doesn't necessarily mean just financial prosperity, by the way. That's one way the faith preachers, the name it and claim it gang, heretics, that's how they screw up the scriptures, by one of the ways, by making this word mean just financial prosperity. It means more than that. It just means success. Like, may the gospel be prosperous. May it be successful. But we don't, there's an old Latin phrase, abusus non tollit usum. The abuse does not bar the use. Just because the Copenhagenites have abused this verse, that does not mean that we can't use the verse. You obey God's commandments. Now, of course, God's commandments are repromulgated in the new covenant under the law of Christ. And so we obey the law of Christ now. But much of the law of Moses is in the law of Christ, and the idea is the same. You obey God's commands, you prosper. In general, that doesn't mean that you won't face suffering now and then. According to God's sovereignty, if he has you to go through a trial, you're going to go through a trial. But he also has ways to deliver you from the trial. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Deuteronomy 5. We are now prepared to go to Deuteronomy 6. Verses 1 through 25, the entire chapter, and we'll talk about what is the greatest commandment. Hope to see you then. Hope you enjoyed this audio.